All right, so before I get started, I need to get kind of an idea of who I'm talking to here. If I said the word Fortran, does anybody know what I'm talking about? All right. Programmers, how many people actually like sit at a keyboard and program code? All right, you just have to kind of like clap because I can't tell. How many of those programmers are Java programmers? Oh, cool. How many are like Python programmers? C programmers? Fortran programmers? Assembler programmers? Okay, I know who I'm talking to. And so I'm going to motivate my talk tonight, and this is fun stuff, but I want you to think about instead of writing the next app to find the best burrito in town, think about writing the next program that calculates the next gen engine, you know, the full engine simulation in an hour instead of a day. So I'm trying to motivate you to do a different kind of computing. 10 to the 18th is called exascale in the computing world, and we're going to be talking about exaflops. But before we go there, I'm going to show you where we started from. This is the ENIAC. This is one of the first computers. This you don't even program. There's no keyboard. If you wanted to program this thing, you actually turned knobs and plugged in cables, and it calculated one thing. And it's not good for texting. Okay, so thought experiment here. I want everybody to pretend that you pull out a calculator and you type 2 times 3 and you hit the equal sign. Okay, that's called a flop, a floating point operation. If everybody in this room did that at the same time in 1 second, that would be 100 flops. If everybody in the world, 7 billion people, did 2 times 3 on a calculator every second, and every second of a year, that would be on the order of 10 to the 17th power flops. So that's the kind of, once you wrap your head around a billion people calculating on a calculator for a whole year, and we're talking about computers that could do that in 1 second, second after second after second. So that's the kind of computing that we're talking about. We're not finding burritos here. Okay, so to get there, so that's a flop. So to compute, again, I'm not trying to put down Java programmers, but a lot of time Java programmers just have like no sense of what actually goes on in the hardware. They're writing object-oriented code and calling this library and that website, and so what is a flop, right? So if I actually want to calculate something on a calculator or on a computer, I have a processor, I have a chip. And in that chip, I have some registers. And I have some data that's out in memory someplace. And that memory could be hierarchical, or it could be on storage. But basically, I have to get two numbers, A and B, from memory into my chip. And then I do a calculation, and that's a result. And then I store that someplace. And I'm trying to do 10 to the 18th of those every second. So that's what I'm showing here, right? So we got some memory. And we put them in registers. We do a multiply. Actually, now they got these things called multiply add units. But that's how we used to do it. I work for a company called Cray. And back in the 80s, we were the hottest thing around. Because we could do our calculations, which are terribly slow right now. Our machine back in the 80s is dumber than an iPhone. But at the time, we were 100 times faster than anybody else. And the reason is because we did something different. Instead of going to memory, this takes a lot of clocks to get stuff out of memory. So instead of going to memory and say, I'm just going to grab this number and come back and calculate it with it, we did what's called vector processing. And so we would say, I'm going to go to memory, and I'm going to get this word and the next 127 words, and I'm going to bring them all in at the same time, and I'm going to set up what's called a pipeline, and I'm going to stuff it full of numbers. And once I get this thing rolling, I can get a result every clock, as opposed to a result every 50 clocks or something like that. That worked for a while. Then the microprocessor, Intel, woke up, and they're the leaders right now. And what they did is said, instead of doing this vector processing stuff, I'm going to make a cache. So I'm going to partition off a bit of my chip, and I'm going to use it as a place where I can hide stuff. And so I'm going to go off to memory. I'm going to grab some stuff, and I'm going to put it in my cache. It's right next to my registers, and I'm going to try and reuse that cash. And if you can reuse that cash, you're going to be going fast. If you can't, then you're going to be going slow. So that's what microprocessors are doing today. And then Intel, anybody heard of the Moore's Law? That was a rule that was set up, 20 years ago, and this guy said processors get twice as fast every 18 months or something like that. Well, we've hit that wall, and we've hit that wall a long time ago. And so instead of putting more and more circuits in a chip into a processor, because you really can't do anything more to make it faster, they're doing what's called parallel processing. So a chip now actually contains many small processors. And you have this today on your phones and on your laptops. If you have an iCore 2 or something like that, that means you actually have two processors in there. Today's Haswells have 16. So now what we do, before we were saying, let's go out the memory, let's go grab a bunch of stuff and bring it in and calculate it. The only problem with that is you had to be kind of doing the same thing to all those numbers at the same time. If I wanted to do a bunch of different kind of things, I say, okay, well, I'm going to bring in 16 different things and have different people working on different things at the same time. Can you kind of see that this is getting more complex? So now, it's kind of funny because Cray did vectors in the 80s, and then we got out of the business, and out of the vector business, and then Intel started these processors, and maybe a couple of years ago, they started putting in these things called SSE instructions, and lo and behold, those are like little short vectors, and now they're making those vectors longer. So now we have chips. So this is a node. So this would be like a laptop. And inside there, there's going to be two sockets. So this is socket one and socket two. And each inside each socket is a multi-core processor, which has 18 cores. But those cores are divided up in what these things called NUMA nodes. And then what we do is we tie multiples of these together. And we make these very big machines. And I'm going to show you some pictures at the end. But I'm going to show you a picture of a machine that has 300,000 cores, these guys, in a machine that's all wired together. And people like me and a lot of other people write these codes that are like a million lines long that can actually spread their job out across 300,000 little workers and get them to calculate things like jet engines. All right, so the complexity is just getting terrible. And then to add on top of that is because we've kind of hit this wall and we can't go any faster, now everybody's kind of, the game is kind of changing and everybody's kind of like going off in different directions. There's these things called graphics units. Whenever you do something on a computer, right, you get the graphics on your screen. Well, some clever guys thought, well, there's a little matrix multiply unit inside the thing that displays on my screen. I'm going to use that for calculating,
Bitcoin
or thermodynamics. All right, we're trying to do useful things here. All right, and then they made these things called GPUs, which are general purpose graphics processing units. So basically what you're doing, in fact, okay, quiz time. Anybody clap if anybody knows what an 8087 chip is. So back in the, 80s, Intel had a chip, one of the first chips that was actually a computer chip called an 8086 chip, and that was your actual processing unit. And if you wanted to do a square root, it took you 50 clock cycles to do it because you had to do all this math to do the square root. And so someone said, well, I'm just going to put that all in hardware, and I'm going to calculate a square root in one clock cycle, but you had a separate chip. And I remember motherboards that had a separate size. So if you wanted to do fast math, you bought another chip and you plugged it in, and it was called a coprocessor. And you basically offload work to this like helper chip that was stupid, but knew how to do one or two things really fast. And that's what these things are. They're very stupid, and they only work in certain situations, but when they work, they're fast. you got crazy people like this. This is people who do molecular dynamics, and these astrophysicist guys, they said, all we do is this one calculation and we really don't care about anything else, so I'm just going to make my own chip. So they just made a chip that does their own thing. I did a lot of stuff in field programmable gate arrays, and this is a chip that you can actually, again, just like the other ones, you can program the chip to do just one calculation. They're nice because you can actually change what that calculation is every once in a while, but not too much. Quantum computing is too far off. People are doing optical stuff. Okay, I'm going to keep moving on. So this is Cray 1, the vintage 1976. You know, this is just where we're going, you know. And the thing to look at here is just the number of transistors, you know, 184 million transistors. And I just, Googled Haswell processors, 1.4 billion transistors. So transistors are those actual little things that calculate the answer. And the thing to think about is like an add unit, something that actually adds two numbers like hundreds of transistors that do actually do that. All right, we're going to move along here. The other thing that's kind of interesting here is power. Not only are these things kind of hit the wall on frequency, they just can't go any faster, so we're going wider. They're consuming much more power. People don't realize that. When I do that flop, right, and I'm going to calculate A times B equals C, I'm going to spend three times more energy just moving A and B around than I do actually calculating the result. So it's kind of interesting. So we have to kind of think outside our normal things. So that's where we're at. And this is what, you know, worries me, I guess, or what should worry you is this is the top 500 list. If you're ever, you know, a geek and bored, this is a good place to go. This is an organization that lists the 500 fastest computers in the world. Number one is a system in China. Number two is a Cray machine in Oak Ridge. And they like to put out these graphs. And this red line here is the fastest computer in the world. And you can see, like, sometimes this is actually the numerical weather simulator in Japan. And they kind of leapfrogged everybody. And then they were the fastest computer in the world for like 2 or 3 years in a row before someone else could catch up to them. And we're in that situation today with the system in China. They just put a ton of money into it. They built this really fast machine, and people are trying to beat them now. This is the slowest machine on the top 500, so this is kind of like smooths out the line. And then this is the summation of all the machines on the line. And what you can see is, I hope you guys know what log scales are, right? This is log scale. And, you know, this is a jump of 1,000 every time. You know, so we're dramatically increasing the number of calculations we can do per second. But most people were looking at these lines and they're saying, oh, geez, you know, I can throw a line, I can interpolate across here. And they all said, okay, exaflop, 10 to the 18th calculations per second is going to happen, you know, in 2016. It's going to happen next year. And then this graph just actually came out like 2 weeks ago. And someone says, well, you know, if you just kind of look at the last bit of these lines, you know, the curve has kind of changed. And so that's what's happening now, is that we're kind of falling off our progression for the last 20 years. So how am I doing on time? Am I like halfway or three quarters?
Yeah.
Okay. How am I doing on attitude? Am I too boring or too exciting? All right, I guess that's good too. So computers aren't getting faster, they're getting wider. And I'm trying to, although this is like kind of depressing, I'm trying to encourage you to embrace this complexity and convince all your buddies to get into the world of high performance computing. So we got to be cleverer. We got to figure out how to spread work around more. There's this thing called Amdahl's law. You know, I said that we have a machine that's 300,000 cores, and there's this, you know, stuff called parallel computing. And usually you kind of compute something, and then you get to a spot where you gotta kind of talk to your buddies, you know, get some kind of an answer, and then you can move on. And you get an answer, you kind of move on. Think about 300,000 cores calculating an answer, and then like one guy has to wait for something. You have 299,000 other cores that are just going to sit there going, okay, I'm ready. So that's the whole trick here, is to try and keep everybody, you know, all these processors engaged and running. There's other things. I'm going to kind of skip over some of this stuff. You know, just the wires that connect this stuff. I mean, we used to use copper. Now we can't use copper because these machines have to get so big. I'm going to show you some pictures of computers that are 300 cabinets. You know, think of 300 refrigerators in a basketball court. I mean, that's what these things are. And literally, the machine on the end is actually too far away to use copper, so the signal can't even get there. So now we got to use optics to get the to get everybody talking again. Yes. Implications for programmers, right, that's us. So all you guys, you know, drop your Python, pick up C. You want to use a programming language called MPI, Message Passing Interface. That's called for distributed computing. That's basically a language that lets you move data from one node to another. You're basically setting up like a mailbox, and you say, okay, I'm going to send node data from this guy to another guy. And then we want to, inside those cores, remember I said there's 32 little cores inside the one node. We want to do what's called threaded programming or OpenMP programming, so that because that's faster, lower overhead. So you do that inside the core. So you do this stuff called heterogeneous computing. You take your problem, you take your aircraft or your jet engine, and you break it up into a bunch of little pieces or a bunch of big pieces, and then you take those pieces to the node, and then you break those up into smaller pieces, and then you take those pieces and you vectorize some of those pieces, and you kind of orchestrate this whole thing, and you get an answer. You really don't want to have a scalar operation. You really don't want someone to say, I can't do nothing until I get this answer, and I can't do nothing until I get that answer, because that's just going to throttle the whole process. You got to figure out how to streamline, how to vectorize, you know, everything that you're working on. And locality, because data is, the calculations don't matter anymore, it's moving data. And it's all about how to efficiently partition data, how to lay out your data so that you can stream through this data. All right, and then we have to worry about these goofy stuff. I mean, how do we offload stuff effectively and make use of them, and how do we keep the processor that's offloading the work still doing useful calculations? And this is a marketing slide for Cray. We built tools to help you do it. That's it. So this is kind of a picture. This is where we're going. So this is what my earlier pictures were about. So we have processors, we have memory, and we have storage. This is that disk that, or back in the old days, you had floppies, right? This is the hard disk that that you store your permanently data on. And so what's happening now is you're having, because your memory is too far away and you have the caches are in the chip, but maybe you want to have some kind of SRAM or some kind of memory that's in between your memory and your processor that you can kind of cache data in. And then you might have some SSDs. These are flash drives, like you might have in a car, in a camera or something, because they're faster than this. So basically what you're doing is you're basically stuffing in memory that's as fast as possible, but usually the faster it is, the less it holds. So what you have to do is you kind of have to stuff memory, different kinds of memory, in this whole computation chain to try and speed up the whole calculation. This is where, you know, when you're the programmer, you have to understand all that and try and make effective use of it. If this isn't hard enough, the world is changing. Anybody know Hadoop? Anybody hear of Hadoop and Spark and Sparkle queries? So this is the high performance computing. People really don't care about productivity so much as just getting an answer as fast as possible. Well, you got this whole world of people out here who really don't care about how fast their answer gets, just that they want an answer. People like the Yahoos and the Googles in the world, you know, they want an answer no matter what. And so they do Hadoop and MapReduce, and what they try to do is they try to actually do things in parallel such that if one fails along the way, they still get an answer for somebody else. Well, that's totally inefficient from an HPC perspective and wastes a lot of energy. And so what we're trying to do is not only do our job, our HPC job, but we're also trying to figure out how to do the big data job at the same time. And so we're trying to move productivity kind of things from the big data world into HPC, and we're trying to move the performance stuff from HPC into the big data world. And it's tricky. And then there's these things called clouds. Clouds, in my mind, are just silly. Because think of this. I mean, I'm a guy who actually wants to know that my data is in this cache and this register because I want to do as many of them as possible, as fast as possible. And you're going to give me a thing that's not even an OS. It's like an OS on top of an OS. And I don't know where I'm sitting. And so I could have two nodes that are literally 100 yards apart. And you want me to do calculations on that thing. So it's a totally different world. But it does have portability of use. You know, if I just want to do this calculation once a year, I can see the value of that. This is one of the machines I was talking about, NERSC. I did the math on this one as I was sitting, getting ready. 50 cabinets. Each cabinet has on the order of 6,144 cores. So this has like 307,000 cores in it. And we're actually using big data to kind of analyze our big machines. And because I have 1 minute left, I want you to be a HPC programmer. And I have a whole bunch of slides on Chapel, which I'm just going to kind of nix. So another way to do this is to invent new languages. So Cray has actually got a contract from DARPA to invent a new language called Chapel. And the idea is to, when I want to calculate something, I'm going to use a different language that allows me to express the problem, the mathematics, in a way that a compiler can understand it and map it to the machine as best as possible. Okay, I just want to show you a couple pictures at the end here because I'm skipping Chapel. This is a hydrodynamics calculation. These are the lines in Chapel. It took 1,200 lines to calculate the shock wave in that example, and it would have been four times more lines of code, in C and OpenMP. And what's nice is all of the data structures that actually lays out the data is isolated, so you can change it if the machine changes. This is the motivational slide. Climate change is all done on these machines, and they use all of those computational resources. And just to give you an idea of what they're actually doing when they calculate the weather, here's the Earth. You fill up a bunch of cells around the whole Earth, and then you model how the wind moves out of one cell into the next cell. And then this is the jet engine I was talking about. Look at the complexity. And they model the spinning turbines, and they calculate the combustion, and they calculate all the airflow through it. So this is what exascale is about. This is molecular dynamics. And I'm going to skip the summary and just get to the picture. There's where we're at today. So these are some machines from Cray. And you'll notice that these are all petaflops. And exaflops is 1,000 times faster than a petaflop. And so that's where we're headed.